Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Rachel Bitticoffer, political strategist and author, who assesses the outcome of the 2024 election and how the Democrats' many failures contributed to Donald Trump's re-election victory. Author and commentator Sarah Kendzior, who examines Attorney General Merrick Garland's 2.5-year delay in indicting Trump for his crimes, paving the way for his election victory and the imminent installation of his mafia regime. And Sultana Hussein of the Amazon Labor Union and New York Labor for Palestine, who talks about the urgent need for labor activists to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people during Israel's brutal war in Gaza. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Medicare Advantage, run by private insurance companies, is an offshoot of Original Medicare, the federal insurance program for people over age 65 and those with certain disabilities. More than half of eligible Medicare beneficiaries now get their coverage through the Advantage program that typically charges low or no premiums and offers dental, vision, and prescription drug coverage that aren't included with traditional Medicare. But this year, many insurers are eliminating their Medicare Advantage plans from counties and states they've deemed to be unprofitable. This means that more than 1 million seniors will now be forced to shop for new health insurance policies. Though most companies haven't yet released information on which states will see program cuts, Stateline News reports plans will be shut down in Alabama, Massachusetts, Missouri, New Hampshire, New Mexico, and Vermont. Medicare Advantage programs are more likely than traditional Medicare to require prior authorization for hospital stays and expensive treatments. These restrictions prompted an investigation by Democratic Senate staff, which found the nation's largest Medicare Advantage insurers denied a quarter of all prior authorization requests for post-acute care in nursing homes, rehabilitation hospitals, and long-term care facilities. The operators of Toronto-based TD Bank agreed to pay a $3 billion settlement with the U.S. government after pleading guilty to conspiracy to commit money laundering, the largest bank in U.S. history to do so. Canadian-based TD Bank is the 10th largest bank in the U.S. Biden administration Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a statement that high-level TD Bank executives were alerted to serious problems with the bank's anti-money laundering program, but failed to correct them, as employees openly joked about how easy it seemed to be for criminals to launder money there. The Justice Department said the bank allowed at least three different money laundering networks to move a total of $670 million over a period of several years, proceeds from terrorist financing, and fentanyl, narcotics, and human trafficking. TD joins a long list of international banks accused of moving $2 trillion in illicit cash through the U.S. financial system over 8 years. Antarctica, Earth's southernmost continent, home to penguins, abundant marine life, and several thousand scientists and their staff, is owned by no nation. Since 1961, it has been governed by the members of the Antarctic Treaty, mandating its use for peaceful purposes only. For decades, the treaty was widely regarded as a model of effective global cooperation. But today, a dark cloud looms over Antarctica as international cooperation governing the frozen continent appears to be breaking down. The U.S., Russia, and China are conflicting with one another as they scramble to exploit Antarctica's resources. In late October, an international summit on preserving marine life in the Antarctic stalled after Russia and China vetoed every proposal. Global warming is making Antarctica's waters more accessible, and new technologies will make mining possible where vast deposits of oil, gas, copper, and other valuable minerals could be found. The climate crisis is also giving fishing fleets greater access to stocks of krill. Although using the continent for military purposes is prohibited under the treaty, a number of nations are now exploiting a loophole that permits the construction of dual-use facilities and technologies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After Vice President Kamala Harris's defeat in the presidential election, there's been no shortage of explanations as to why she lost to Donald Trump, an unpopular twice-impeached convicted felon found liable for sexual assault and who incited a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Many voters cast their ballot against Harris or stayed home simply because of her race and gender, while others blame President Biden for the post-pandemic spike in inflation. Still others were outraged by the Biden administration's unconditional support for Israel's slaughter of tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza. While there's some truth in all these explanations, another more frightening reason behind voters' candidate choices is the fact that typical low-information citizens know very little about current events or candidates' positions on issues important to them. Confirmation of this can be found in two blind polls conducted before the election, which found that across nearly all issues, policies backed by Harris and the Democratic Party were on average more popular than those backed by Trump and the Republican Party. Your reporter spoke with Rachel Bitticoffer, a political scientist, election forecaster, and author of the book, Hit 'Em Where It Hurts, How to Save Democracy by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game. Here she discusses her analysis on why Trump won the election, owing to the Democrats' failure to widely declare their support of policies appealing to the broad swath of working-class voters. She begins by analyzing why so many women who voted to support abortion rights in states with reproductive rights referendums this year also voted for Donald Trump.
Most Americans don't consume any type of hard news, like the vast, vast majority. And our assumption is that everyone's like us. Everyone knows who Mike Johnson is. Everyone knows what the filibuster is. Everyone understands that the president's power is extremely muted by the House and the Senate and what happens there. Average Americans know absolutely none of that, okay? And so, like, one of my pre-cycle, pre-election, you know, jobs was to try to convince these candidates to understand you won't benefit naturally from this initiative. People will walk in and they will vote yes on the initiative and then vote for the abortion banning Republicans on the same ballot. And they will do that unless you teach them that Republicans ban abortion, because as insane as that sounds to our audience right now, many, many millions of Americans up to today have no idea that abortion has been banned, let alone would be able to articulate who caused that problem for them, okay? And it is tremendously frustrating to be on the tail end of an election that the stakes, they were different. We may not even have democracy going forward.
Overall, apart from what you just said, Rachel, what did Kamala Harris's campaign do right? What did they get wrong? One conclusion reached by many observers is that the Democrats this year, and of course over recent decades, have turned their back on core issues prioritized by the working class in this country. And they let big money, Wall Street Democratic Party donors, influence their economic policy agenda. What's your take on that observation?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually what my topic is for the article that came out today on the cycle. It really is based on a graph that came out from Financial Times that showed over decades how voters stopped saying that Democrats understood or fought for the working class, okay? And it used to be a huge advantage for Democrats, and over the decades, you see that collapse. And of course, it's the same decades, folks, where Reaganomics obliterated the working class. So that's bad, right? And at the same time, you see the graph go up for people, our brand, right? And that's what you're asking voters to identify here is, you know, what do you associate with the brand of Democrats, you know, takes care or fights for marginalized groups. And as I say in the cycle, I mean, that's a good thing, right? That's a good thing to me. I'm a liberal Democrat. It's a good thing to you. It's a good thing to the audience. But unfortunately, in terms of the broader electorate, most people are not hardwired to think like us. In fact, most people are hardwired to not just not care about what we call out-groups, people who are not like them. Many are actually hostile in addition to that, right? And the Republican regime, like their messaging and strategic communication regime, is very focused on exploiting that out-group hostility, right? I mean, we're not suggesting in any way you give up and champion these causes, okay? But our communications, our ads, our strategy, our messaging needs to be focused on rebranding us as a fighting for the working class. And the reason why that's important, folks, is because you can't win national elections or swing states, and you certainly can't get more Senate votes than 50 if you aren't attracting working class voters. And maybe you might be thinking white working class, which is certainly a subset of the working class, but the working class across the board, despite or regardless of their ethnicity or race, moved right, significantly right, okay? And the working class of today, it used to be a very white-heavy demographic in the 1940s or whatever, but today's working class is racially and ethnically diverse, right? So we're losing these voters, even though we're focusing on a lot of this micro-targeted, what we call identity politics-based strategy that we've been doing really since Obama. And as I point out, it worked in 2008. It was exciting and new technology to be able to go down and say, okay, you're Asian American, we're going to target you on this, and you're a Black American, we're going to target you here. That was natural, a natural impulse, because the Democratic coalition is not like the Republican coalition. It is, theirs is homogenous, white, Christian, right? Ours is all these different interest groups. And our goal was like, okay, well, we have to, in our message, and we want to be representing all these things. Well, the problem with that, folks, is that when you, as I'm trying to pound into people, the electorate is not us. The electorate is nowhere even near us. The electorate knows nothing. And if you want it to know even one thing, you got to pound that one thing with all your comms, all your messaging, right? It has to hammer and hammer it. So that's the shift that we're going to have to make. It's going to be painful for a lot of the system that we've built, which is very intensive on, you know, these niche type of appeals. And I think what we need to create is a story. You know, anyone who spends time on social media interacting with Trump voters will tell you Trump voters are often citing Democratic policies that they believe Trump and Republicans will deliver to them. So clearly we're not making that case well, right? And so that's what the future is going to be focused on.
That was political scientist Rachel Bitticoffer, author of the book Hit 'Em Where It Hurts. Find a link to Rachel's articles on her Cycle Substack page by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the weeks after Donald Trump's election victory, corporate media is breathlessly reporting on all the president-elect's bizarre and unqualified cabinet nominations. That includes Representative Matt Gaetz for Attorney General, who's been under investigation for sex trafficking with underage girls, Fox News host Pete Hegseth for Defense Secretary, who paid a financial settlement to a woman who accused him of rape, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Health and Human Services Secretary, a promoter of deadly anti-science conspiracy theories, and former Representative Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence, who's accused of repeating Kremlin talking points verbatim. As Trump's authoritarian clown car takes shape, the first former president ever to be charged with and convicted of felonies will escape legal accountability for all of his alleged crimes. That includes his attempt to subvert the 2020 election taking classified documents to his Florida estate, and the postponement of any sentence in his New York conviction for covering up a hush money payoff to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Trump's 2024 candidacy and election victory was made possible by President Biden's Attorney General Merrick Garland's 2.5-year delay in indicting the twice-impeached president for his serious crimes. This enabled his expensive lawyers to slow-walk the court cases and invite intervention by the U.S. Supreme Court, which ultimately gave Trump absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Kendzior, author of the book They Knew, How a Culture of Conspiracy Keeps America Complacent, who reflects on the fact that under Biden, the United States became the first country in modern world history to face an attempted coup and then failed to punish the coup plotters, allowing them to run and win the next election.
Yes, this is a tremendous failure, and you're one of the few hosts who allowed me to speak about it in public. There is a tremendous effort to lie about what Merrick Garland was doing, to make up all these stories that he was secretly fixing things behind the scenes. But that was not happening. It was not going to happen. And that was very clear from the start, because Merrick Garland was installed by people deeply tied to Jared Kushner. He was installed by Jared Kushner's lawyer, who is his lifelong mentor. That's a woman named Jamie Gorelick. So already I was wary when he came in. I thought maybe the gravity of the situation would cause him to do the right thing, but that was not the case. And, you know, people really should grasp that this has never happened in world history. I'm kind of astonished by the dearth of scholars who are not pointing this out. All of these scholars of authoritarianism and fascism and so forth, there has never been a openly plotted coup in which the coup plotters and all of their helpers were not punished and were allowed to stay in Congress and were allowed to make laws. And then the coup plotter was allowed to run for president again, like Mafia Grover Cleveland. I mean, it's nuts. Like, it has never happened, even in the most severe authoritarian regimes. But people thought Biden would make real change. They thought that Biden would hold Trump accountable. It became clear to me in the spring of 2021 that Biden and the DOJ and Congress were going to do nothing to hold Trump accountable. And it has been horrible to know that for 3 full years and watch people kind of delude themselves with Jack Smith and all of these other kind of illusory figures. Because it's a tragedy, because the people that get hurt in the end are ordinary American people, and especially the most vulnerable groups, you know, immigrants, migrants, anybody who's not white, women, you know, like all sorts of people are going to suffer because of this. And that is on Joe Biden and his administration and that choice to let Trump go free.
Sarah, in your recent post-election newsletter, you observed that Trump's threat to democracy is much more about a mafia state takeover than it is about fascism or authoritarianism. Expand on that, if you would.
Yes, this is another thing that I think folks are getting wrong, because while it's true that Trump, he certainly uses fascist rhetoric, he supports a lot of authoritarian policies. You see them laid out in Project 2025. I don't think Trump as an individual cares about any of those policies, but, you know, he does what his ideologues tell him. He's more of a figurehead. Nonetheless, it's dangerous for the American people. But what he does want to do, and what the people surrounding him want to do, whether it's plutocrats like Elon Musk or the Russian mafia oligarchs and Israeli oligarchs that he's, you know, been associated with for about, you know, 30 or 40 years, they want the country to collapse. What they want is something akin to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then afterwards, in the 1990s, oligarchs looted and pillaged and made themselves extremely wealthy while letting the country fall apart. And it's a different situation because, you know, the USSR was a tyrannical regime, and then it had, you know, individual republics that were bound together. But that's why so many pundits and so many politicians have been pushing this fake red state, blue state narrative to try to come up with something equivalent, like this state is inherently different than the other state, you know, and therefore we need a national divorce. And that's absolute nonsense. What you mostly have is a country of disillusioned, fed up people that don't really fit neatly into any political category and that need to hold on to the integrity of this country as a whole. Because if they try to split us up It's going to be a bunch of warring little plutocrat fiefdoms that will try to get resources. And I think the motivation behind this is climate change. It's a fear of losing, you know, food, water, basic things, of those becoming more scarce. So these oligarchs and plutocrats want to hoard them. You know, this is a logical strategy. It's also incredibly evil, and ordinary people will suffer. But it's not quite fascism, because fascism requires a loyalty to the state, a desire to expand the state, and that's never been what Trump's interested in. You know, he's a corporate raider. He was a corporate raider in New York, and he kind of views the United States as something, you know, that needs to crash and collapse, and then it has the most utility to him and his friends.
That was Sarah Kendziar, author of the book They Knew, How a Culture of Conspiracy Keeps America Complacent. Find a link to Sarah's recent articles on her Substack newsletter by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Although debate on Israel's ongoing brutal war in Gaza and expansion of the conflict to Lebanon was mostly absent in the U.S. presidential election campaign, peace and Palestine solidarity activists continue to demand an end to the slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza, where more than 43,000 have been killed. And in light of repeated violations of international and U.S. law, hundreds of advocacy groups are calling on Congress to immediately suspend future U.S. arms transfers to Israel. After Donald Trump's victory in the U.S. election, activists nationwide are gathering to discuss strategies to more effectively influence U.S. Middle East policy. On November 16th, the Connecticut Palestine Solidarity Coalition held a regional conference in Hartford called Breaking Chains, Building Bridges, attended by some 200 activists. 10 panels included such topics as campus repression, prison abolition, Connecticut's links with the war economy, and building Palestine solidarity in the labor movement. The conference plenary session featured 5 speakers who are leading state and national struggles, including Sultana Hussein, recording secretary with the Amazon Labor Union and co-chair of New York Labor for Palestine, part of a national formation. In this excerpt of her talk, she addressed the need for working people to be in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle and gave specific examples of how this is happening around the country.
I'm here to basically talk about like a critical aspect of this fight, like our collective responsibility as members of the international working class, as organized workers in the labor movement, to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The labor movement has always been a cornerstone of resistance to oppression, and in the fight for Palestinian liberation, our role is as essential as ever. So Labor for Palestine was founded in 2004 by union activists and members of the Palestinian community, and it was established to reclaim the legacy of working class solidarity with Palestine in the US. This legacy is rooted in historic actions like the groundbreaking statements of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in 1969, and the bold wildcat strikes against the UAW leadership's support for Israel in 1973. So history shows us that labor has always played a pivotal role in liberation struggles, and it's a force for justice and change. From the fight against apartheid in South Africa to the global anti-colonial movements of the 20th century, workers have used their collective power to disrupt oppressive systems, refusing to allow our labor to fund injustice. These historic actions, they remind us of the tremendous power of organizing. Solidarity is an action word. And as rank and file trade unionists, we're uniquely positioned to act. Our power lies in our ability to disrupt systems of exploitation at their core, to shut down production, to interrupt supply chains, and to withhold our labor when it is being used to perpetuate injustice. This means taking concrete steps, including demanding an immediate end to the siege in Gaza and halting all U.S. military aid to Israel, following the example of Block the Boat, ILWU, West Coast Dockers, and workers worldwide who refuse to build, transport, and support weapons for Israel. This also means respecting the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, BDS, severing ties with Israel's labor federation, the Histadrut, and its U.S. mouthpiece, the Jewish Labor Committee. This includes divesting from Israel bonds and industries profiting from Zionist settler colonialism and occupation. And across the world, unions and organized workers have already taken meaningful steps. Just to name a few examples, in New York, education and city workers have called for divestment of their retirement savings and pensions from contributing to Israeli occupation and genocide. SEIU 1021 passed a divestment resolution and won. CIR, which is a residents' physicians' union, passed a resolution to refuse to endorse genocidal candidates at their national convention. And Google tech workers organized occupations of offices across the country in New York and California in an escalation of the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. And over 50 workers were fired in retaliation. And I think they knew the risks involved, but they were ready to put it all on the line. And that's what we need to do. And these actions really demonstrate the immense power we have when we align our labor with principles of justice and liberation. I'm going to talk a little bit about my own union. We've taken stands to hold Amazon accountable as a war profiteer. In December 2023, my caucus, the ALU Democratic Reform Caucus, passed our Palestine resolution, which was later adopted by my union. And later in the same month, my caucus organized a work stoppage, and several dozen warehouse workers at JFK in Staten Island walked out in solidarity with the Palestinian Liberation Movement.
That was Sultana Hussein, recording secretary with the Amazon Labor Union and co-chair of New York Labor for Palestine, speaking at the Connecticut Palestine Solidarity Coalition Conference on November 16th. Her talk was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about the conference by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KCBP in Modesto, California, Global Community Radio nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.